content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Larissa Biggers from North Carolina Reading Service. I'll be reading for Harrison 2 from The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas, translated and with an introduction and notes by Robin Boos. Today, I'll be reading chapters 2 and 3 of The Count of Monte Cristo, and I'll begin with chapter 2, entitled Father and Son. We shall leave danglers, gripped by the demon of hatred, trying to poison the ship owner's ear with some malicious libel against his comrade, and follow Dantes, who, after walking along the Canebière, took the Rue Noire, entered a small house on the left side of the Allée de Meun, and hastened up the four flights of a dark stairway. There, holding the banister with one hand, while the other repressed the beating of his heart, he stopped before a half-open door through which he could see to the back of a small room. In this room lived Dante's father. News of the arrival of the Pharaon had not reached the old man, who was standing on a chair, engaged with trembling hands in pinning up some nasturtiums and clematis that climbed across the trellis outside his window. Suddenly, he felt himself grasp around the waist, and a well-known voice exclaimed behind him, "Father! My dear father!" The old man cried out and turned around, and then, seeing his son, fell into his arms, pale and trembling. "What is it, father?" the young man exclaimed with concern. "Are you not well?" "No, no, dear Edward, my son, my child. No, but I was not expecting you, and the joy, the shock of seeing you like this unexpectedly. Oh, heavens, it is too much for me." "Now, father, calm yourself. I am really here. They always say that joy cannot harm you, which is why I came without warning. Come now, smile. Don't look at me like that with those wild eyes. I am back, and there is happiness in store for us." "I am pleased to hear it, my boy," the old man continued. "But what happiness? Are you going to stay with me from now on? Come on, tell me about your good fortune." "God forgive me," the young man said, "for rejoicing at a good fortune which has brought grief to the family of another. But God knows, I never wished for it, but it happened, and I do not have the heart to grieve at all. Our good Captain Leclerc is dead, father, and it seems likely that, thanks to Monsieur Morel's support, I shall have his command. Do you understand, father? A captain, at 20, with a salary of 100 louis and a share in the profits. Isn't that better than a poor sailor like myself could expect?" "Yes, my son, yes," said the old man. "This is indeed a stroke of luck. So I want you to have a little house with the first money I earn and a garden to grow your clematis, your nasturtiums, and your honeysuckle. But what is wrong, father? You look ill." "An instant. Don't worry. It's nothing." And his strength failing him, he leaned back. "Father," cried the young man, "come, have a glass of water, a glass of wine. It will revive you. Where do you keep your wine?" "No, thank you. Don't bother to look for it." "There is no need," he replied, trying to restrain his son. "Yes, there is, father. Show me." He opened one or two cupboards. "It is a waste of time," the old man said. "There is no wine left." "What? No wine?" Dante said, paling in turn as he looked from the old man's sunken, livid cheeks to the empty cupboards. "What? You have no wine left? Have you been short of money, father?" "Oh, I'm short of nothing now that you are here," said the old man. "But I left you 200 francs," Dante stammered, wiping the sweat from his brow, 2 months ago as I was leaving." "Yes, yes, Edmund, so you did. But when you left, you forgot a small debt to my neighbor, Caderousse. He reminded me of it, and he said that if I did not settle it on your behalf, he would go and reclaim it from Monsieur Morel. So, you understand, I was afraid it might do you some harm. And I paid it. But, Dantes exclaimed, I owed Caderousse 140 francs. "Yes," the old man mumbled, "and you paid them out of the 200 francs I left you?" His father nodded. "Which means that you lived for 3 months on 60 francs, the young man exclaimed. "You know how small my needs are." "Oh, heaven, heaven, forgive me," Edmund cried, falling on his knees in front of the old man. "What are you doing?" "Oh, you have broken my heart." "Pah, You are here, the old man said with a smile. All is forgotten, because all is well. Yes, I am here, said the young man. Here I am with a fine future and a little money. Here, father, he said, take it. Take it and send out for something immediately. He emptied the contents of his pocket on the table, a dozen gold coins, 5 or 6 5-franc pieces, and some small change. Old Dantes's face lit up. Whose is that? He asked. Mine, thine, ours, of course. Take it, buy some food, and enjoy yourself. There will be more tomorrow. Gently, gently, the old man said, smiling. If you don't mind, I shall go easy on your money. If people see me buying too many things at once, they will think I had to wait for you to come back before I went shopping. Do as you think best, but first of all, father, get yourself a housemaid. I don't want you to live on your own from now on. I have some contraband coffee and some excellent tobacco and a little chest in the hold. You shall have it tomorrow. But hush, someone is coming. That will be Caderousse, who has learned of your arrival and is no doubt coming to welcome you back. There's a fellow who says one thing and thinks another, Edmund muttered. No matter, he is a neighbor who has helped us in the past, so let him come in. Just as Edmund finished saying this under his breath, the black bearded head of Caderousse appeared on the landing, framed in the outer door. A man of 25 or 26 years of age, he was holding a piece of cloth which, being a tailor, he was about to fashion into the lining of a jacket. "You're back again then, Edmund," he said, with a thick Marseille accent and a broad smile, revealing teeth as white as ivory. "As you can see, neighbor, and entirely at your service," Dante replied, this polite formula barely disguising his coldness toward the man. "Thank you, thank you. Fortunately, I need nothing. In fact, it is sometimes others who need me," Dante bridled. "I'm not saying that for you, my boy. I lent you money, and you returned it. That's how things are done between good neighbors, and we're quite. We are never quits towards those who have done us a favor," said Dante. "Even when one ceases to owe them money, one owes them gratitude." "There's no sense in speaking of that. What's in the past is past. Let's talk about your happy news, your happy return, young man. I just happened to go down to the harbor to fetch some brown cloth when I met our friend Danglars." "You're in Marseille," I exclaimed. "Yes, as you see. I thought you were in Smyrna." "It could be, because I have just returned back from there." "And where is young Edmund, then?" "At his father's, I suppose. Danglars told me, so I came back here at once," Caderousse concluded, "to have the pleasure of shaking the hand of a friend." "Dear Caderousse," the old man said, "he is so fond of us." "Indeed I am, and I hold you all in the greater esteem, since honest people are so rare. But it seems you have come into money, my boy," the tailor went on, glancing at the handful of gold and silver that Dantes emptied on the table. The young man observed a flash of greed light up his neighbor's dark eyes. "Heavens, no," he said casually. "That money is not mine. I was just telling my father that I was afraid he might have wanted for something while I was away, and to reassure me, he emptied his purse on the table. Come, father," he continued, "put that money back in your pocket, unless, of course, our neighbor needs some for himself, in which case it is at his disposal." "Oh, indeed not, my boy," said Caderousse. "I need nothing, and thank God my business holds body and soul together. Keep your money, keep it. One can never have too much. Still, I'm obliged for your offer, and as much as if I had taken advantage of it." "It was well meant," said Dantes. "I don't doubt that it was. So, I learned that you are now on good terms with Monsieur Morel. Sly one that you are." "Monsieur Morel has always been very good to me," Dantes answered. "In that case, you are wrong to refuse dinner with him." "What do you mean, refuse dinner? What do you mean, refuse dinner?" old Dantes said. "Did he invite you to dinner?" "Yes, father," said Edmund, smiling at his father's astonishment on learning of this high honor. "So why did you refuse, son?" the old man asked. "So that I could come straight back here, father," the young man answered. "I was anxious to see you." "He must have been put out by it, that good Monsieur Morel," Caderousse remarked. "When one hopes to be made captain, it is a mistake to get on with the wrong side of one's owner." "I explained the reason for my refusal, and I hope he understood it." "Even so, to be promoted to captain, one must flatter one's bosses a little." "I expect to become captain without that," Dantes retorted. "So much the better. All your friends will be pleased for you. And I know someone over there, behind the Citadel Saint-Nicolas, who will not be unhappy about it either. Mercedes? The old man said. Yes, father, Dantes resumed. And with your permission, now that I've seen you, now that I know you are well and you have all you need, I would like to ask your leave to go and visit Le Catalan. Go, child, old Dantes said, and may God bless you, and may God bless you as much as in your wife he has blessed me and my son. His wife, Caderousse said. Hold on, man, hold on. As far as I know, she's not that yet. No, Edmund replied, but in all probability she soon will be. Never mind, said Caderousse, never mind. You have done well to hurry back, my boy. Why? Because Mercedes is a beautiful girl, and beautiful girls are never short of admirers, especially that one. There are dozens of them after her. Really, Edmund said with a smile, not entirely concealing a hint of unease. Oh, yes, Caderousse continued, and some with good prospects, too, but, of course, you're going to be a captain, and she'll be sure not to refuse you. By what you mean, Dante said, smiling, but barely concealing his anxiety, that if I were not a captain. Ah, said Caderousse. Come now, said the young man. I have a better opinion than you of women in general, and Mercedes in particular, and I am persuaded that, whether I were a captain or not, she would remain faithful to me. So much the better. When one is going to get married, it is always a good thing to have faith. But enough of that. Take my advice, lad. Don't waste any time in telling her of your return and letting her know about your aspirations. I'm going at once, said Edmund. He embraced his father, nodded to Caderousse, and left. Caderousse stayed a moment longer, then, taking his leave of the elder Dantes, followed the young man down and went to find Danglars, who was waiting for him on the corner of Rue Senac. Well, Danglars said, did you see him? I've just left them, said Caderousse. And did he talk about his hope of being made captain? He spoke of it as though he had already been appointed. Patience, Danglars said. It seems to me that he is rather too much of a hurry. Why, it seems Monsieur Morel has given him his word. So, is he pleased? He is even insolent about it. He has already offered me his services, like superior personage. He wanted to lend me money, like some banker or other. You refused? Indeed I did, though I could have as well accepted, since I am the one who gave him the first silver coins he ever had in his hands. But now, Monsieur Dantes has no need of anyone. He is going to be a captain. Huh, said Danglars. He is not one yet. My God, it should be a fine thing indeed if he wasn't, said Caderousse. Otherwise, there'll be no talking to him. If we really want, said Danglars, he will stay as he is and perhaps even become less than he is. What do you mean? Nothing. I was talking to myself. Is he still in love with the beautiful Catalan? Madly. He has gone there now. But, unless I am gravely mistaken, he will not find things altogether to his liking. Explain. What does it matter? This is more important than you may think. Why? You don't like Dantes, do you? I don't like arrogance. Well, then tell me what you know about the Catalan woman. I have no positive proof, but I've seen things, and, as I said, that make me think the future captain will not be pleased with what he finds around Chemin de Vie Infirmerie. What have you seen? Come on now, tell me. Well, I've observed that every time Mercedes comes into town, she's accompanied by a large Catalan lad with black eyes, ruddy cheeks, very dark in color, and very passionate, who she calls my cousin. Ah, indeed. Do you think this cousin is courting her? I imagine so. Why else does a fine lad of 21... What else is a fine lad of 21 do to a pretty girl of 17? And you say that Dantes has gone to Le Catalan? He left before me. Suppose we were to go in the same direction, stop at the reserve, and over a glass of La Malgré wine, learn what we can learn. Who would tell us anything? We shall be on the spot, and we'll see what happens from Dantes's face. Let's go then, said Caderousse. But you are paying. Certainly, Danglars replied. The two of them set off at a brisk pace for the spot they had mentioned, and when they arrived, called for a bottle and two glasses. Old Pamphile had seen Dantes go by less than 2 minutes before. Certain that he was in that he was in Le Catalan, they sat under the budding leaves of the plane trees and sycamores, in the branches of which a happy band of birds was serenading one of the first fine days of spring. Chapter 3, Le Catalan. 100 yards away from the place where the two friends, staring into the distance with their ears pricked, were enjoying a sparkling wine, lay the village of Le Catalan, behind a bare hillock ravaged by the sun and the mistral. One day, a mysterious group of colonists set out from Spain and landed on the spit of land where it still resides today. No one knew where they had come from or what language they spoke. One of the leaders, who understood Provençal, asked the commune of Marseille to give them this bare and arid land onto which, like the sailors of antiquity, they had drawn up their little boats. The request was granted, and 3 months later, a little village grew up around 12 or 15 boats that brought these gypsies of the sea. The same village, built in a bizarre and picturesque manner that is partly Moorish and partly Spanish, is the one that can be seen today, inhabited by the descendants of those men who speak the language of their forefathers. For 3 or 4 centuries, they have remained faithful to the little promontory on which they first landed, clinging to it like a flock of seabirds, in no way mixing with the inhabitants of Marseille, marrying among themselves and retaining the habits of dress of their motherland, just as they have retained their tongue. The reader must follow us along the only street of the little village and enter into one of those houses, to the outside of which the sunlight has given a lovely color of dead leaves, that lovely color of dead leaves which is peculiar to the buildings of the country, with inside a coat of whitewash, the only decoration of the Spanish posada. A lovely young girl with jet black hair and the velvet eyes of a gazelle was standing, leaning against an inner wall, rubbing an innocent sprig of heather between slender fingers, like those on a classical statue, and pulling off the flowers, the remains of which were already strewn across the floor. At the same time, in her arms, naked to the elbows, arms that were tan but otherwise seemed modeled on those of Venus of Arles, trembled with a sort of feverish impatience as she was tapping the ground with her supple, well-made foot, revealing a leg that was shapely, bold, and proud, but imprisoned in a red cotton stocking patterned in gray and blue lozenge. A short distance away, a tall young man between 20 and 22 was sitting in a chair, rocking it fitfully on 2 legs while supporting himself on his elbow against an old worm-eaten dresser and watching her with a look that combined anxiety with irritation. His eyes were questioning, but those of the young woman, firm and unwavering, dominated their conversation. "Please, Mercedes," the man said. "Easter's coming around again, and it's a time for weddings. Give me your answer." "You have had it 100 times, Fernand, and you really must like torturing yourself to ask me again." "Well, repeat it, I beg you. Repeat it once more so that I can come to believe it. Tell me for the 100th time that you reject my love, even though your mother approves of me. Convince me that you are prepared to trifle with my happiness, and that of my life and death are nothing to you. My God, to dream for 10 years of being your husband, Mercedes, and then to lose that hope which was the sole aim of my existence." "I at least never encouraged you in that hope, Fernand," Mercedes replied. "You cannot accuse me of having even once flirted with you. I have said repeatedly, I love you like a brother, but never demand anything more from me than this fraternal love, because my heart belongs to another. Isn't that what I have always told you, Fernand?" "Yes, Mercedes, I know," the young man replied. "Yes, you've always been laudably and cruelly honest with me, but you're forgetting that it is a sacred law among Catalans to only marry among themselves." "You're wrong, Fernand. It is not a law, but a custom, nothing more, and I advise you not to appeal to that custom on your behalf. You have chosen for conscription, Fernand, and the freedom that you now enjoy is merely a temporary reprieve. At any moment, you might be called up to serve in the army. Once you are a soldier, what will you do with me? I mean, with a poor orphan girl, sad and penniless, whose only possession is a hut almost in ruins, in which hang a few worn nets, paltry legacy that was left by my father to my mother, and my mother to me. Consider, Fernand, that in the years since she died, I have virtually lived on charity. Sometimes you pretend that I am of some use to you so that you can be justified in sharing your catch with me. And I accept, Fernand, because you are the son of my father's brothers, because we grew up together, and beyond that, most of all, because it would hurt you too much if I were to refuse. But you know full well that the fish I take to the market, which brings me the money to buy the hemp that I spin, I know full well, Fernand, that it is charity. What does it matter, Mercedes, poor and alone as you are, when you suit me thus better than the daughter of the proudest ship owner and the richest banker in Marseille? What do people like us need? An honest wife and a good housekeeper. Where could I find better than you on either score? Fernand, Mercedes replied, shaking her head, one is not a good housekeeper, and one cannot promise to remain an honest woman when one loves a man other than one's husband. Be satisfied with my friendship, for, I repeat, that is all I can promise you, and I only promise what I am sure of being able to give. Yes, I understand, said Fernand. You bear your own poverty patiently, but you are afraid of mine. Well, Mercedes, with your love, I would try and make my fortune. You would bring me luck, and I should become rich. I can cast my fisherman's net wide. I can take a job as a clerk in a shop. I could even become a merchant myself. You can't do any such thing, Fernand. You're a soldier, and if you stay here among the Catalans, it is because there is no war for you to fight. So, remain a fisherman. Don't dream of things that will make reality seem even more terrible to you, and be content with my friendship, because I cannot give you anything else. You're right, Mercedes. I shall be a seaman, and instead of the dress of our forefathers, which you despise, I shall have a patent leather hat, a striped shirt, and a blue jacket with anchors on the buttons. That's how a man needs to dress, isn't it, if he wants to please you? What do you mean? Mercedes asked with an imperious look. What do you mean? I don't understand you. What I mean, Mercedes, is that you are only so hard-hearted and cruel toward me because you are waiting for someone who is dressed like that. But it may be that the one you await for is fickle, and even if he isn't, the sea will be fickle for him. Fernand, Mercedes exclaimed, I thought you were kind, but I was mistaken. It is wicked of you to call on the wrath of God to satisfy your jealousy. Yes, I will not deny it. I'm waiting for the man you describe. I love him. And if he does not return, instead of blaming the fickleness that it pleases you to speak of, I shall think he died loving me. The young Catalan made an angry gesture. I understand what that means, Fernand. You want to blame him because I do not love you and cross his dagger with your Catalan knife. What good would that do you? If you were defeated, you would lose my friendship. If you were the victor, you would see that friendship turn to hatred. Believe me, when a woman loves a man, you do not win her heart by crossing swords with him. No, Fernand, don't be carried away by evil thoughts. Since you cannot have me as your wife, be content to have me as a friend and a sister. In any case, she added, her eyes anxious and filling with tears, stay, Fernand, you said yourself a moment ago that the sea is treacherous. It is already 4 months since he left, and I have counted lots of storms in the past 4 months. Fernand remained impassive. He made no attempt to wipe the tears that were running down Mercedes's cheek, yet he would have given a glass of his own blood for each of those tears, but they were shed for another. He got up, walked around the hut, and returned, stopping before Mercedes with a dark look in his eyes and clenched fist. Come now, Mercedes, he said. Answer me once more. Have you truly made up your mind? I love Edmond Dantès, the young woman said coldly, and no one will be my husband except Edmond. And you love him forever? As long as I live. Fernand bent his head like a discouraged man, gave a sigh that was like a groan, and then suddenly looked up with clenched teeth and nostrils flared. But suppose he is dead? If he's dead, I shall die. And if he forgets you? Mercedes, cried a happy voice outside the house. Mercedes! Ah, the girl exclaimed, reddening with joy and leaping up, filled with love. You see that he has not forgotten me. He is here. And she ran to the door, opened it, crying, come to me, Edmond, I am here. Pale and trembling, Fernand stepped aside as a traveler might do at the sight of a snake, and stumbling against his chair, fell back into it. Edmond and Mercedes were in each other's arms. The hot Marseille sun, shining through the doorway, drenched them in a flood of light. At first, they saw nothing of what was around them. A vast wave of happiness cut them off from the world, and they spoke only those half-formed words were the outpourings of such intense joy that they resembled expressions of pain. Suddenly, Edmund noticed the somber figure of Ferdinand, pale and threatening in the darkness. With a gesture, which he was not even himself aware, the young Catalan had laid his hand on his knife in his belt. "Oh, forgive me," Dante said, raising an eyebrow. "I did not realize that we were not alone." Then, turning to Mercedes, he asked, "Who is this gentleman?" "He will be your friend, Dante, because he is my friend, my cousin, and my brother. This is Ferdinand, which means he is the man whom, after you, I love the most in the world. Don't you recognize him?"
Yes, indeed," said Edmund, and without leaving Mercedes, whose hand he held clasped in one of his own, he extended the other with a cordial gesture toward the Catalan. But Ferdinand, instead of responding with a sign of friendship, remained as silent and motionless as a statue. It was enough to make Edmund look inquiringly from Mercedes, who was trembling with emotion, to Ferdinand, somber and threatening. That one glance told him everything. His brow clouded with rage. "I did not realize that I had hurried round to see you, Mercedes, only to find an enemy here."
"An enemy?" Mercedes exclaimed, looking angrily in the direction of her cousin. "An enemy in my house, you say, Edmund? If I thought that, I should take your arm and go with you to Marseille, leaving this house, never to return." Ferdinand's eyes lit up with rage. "And if any misfortune were to fall you, my dear Edmund," she continued, with the same cool determination, proving to Ferdinand that she had read the sinister depths of his mind, "if any misfortune should happen to you, I should climb up the Cap de Morgaux and throw myself headlong onto the rocks." The blood drained from Fernand's face. "But you are wrong, Edmund," she continued. "You have no enemies here. The only person here is Ferdinand, my brother, who is going to shake your hand like a true friend." With those words, the girl turned her imperious face toward the Catalan, and he, as if mesmerized by her look, slowly came across to Edmund and held out his hand. His hatred, like an impotent wave, had been broken against the ascendancy that the woman exercised over him. But no sooner had he touched Edmund's hand than he felt he had done all that was possible for him to do and rushed out of the house. "Ah," he cried, running along like a madman and burying his hands in his hair. "Ah, who would deliver me from this man? Wretch that I am, wretch that I am. Hey, Catalan, hey, Ferdinand, what are you doing?" a voice called to him. The young man stopped dead, looked around, and saw Caderousse at the table with danglers under a leafy arbor. "What now?" said Caderousse. "Why don't you join us? And why are you in such a hurry that you don't have time to say hello to your friends? Especially when they have almost a full bottle in front of them," danglers added. Ferdinand stared at the two men with a dazed look and did not answer. "He seems a bit down in the dumps," Dangler said, nudging Caderousse with his knee. "Could we be wrong? Contrary to what we thought, could it be that Dantès has got the upper hand?" "Why, we'll just have to find out," said Caderousse. And turning back to the young man, he said, "Well, Catalan, have you made up your mind?" Ferdinand wiped the sweat from his brow, and he slowly made his way under the vault of leaves. That shade appeared to do nothing to calm his spirits and its coolness to bring a measure of well-being back into his exhausted body. "Good day," he said. "I think you called me?"
"I called you because you were running along like a madman. I was afraid you would go and throw yourself into the sea," Caderousse said with a laugh. "Devil take it. When one has friends, it is not only to offer them a glass of wine, but also to stop them from drinking 3 or 4 pints of water."
Ferdinand gave a groan that resembled a sob, and he let his head fall onto his wrists, which were crossed on the table. "Well, now, do you want me to tell you what, Ferdinand?" Caderousse continued, coming straight to the point with that crude brutality of the common man whose curiosity makes him forget any sense of tact. "You look to me like a man who has been crossed in love." He accompanied this quip with a roar of laughter. "Ah," Danglars retorted, "a lad built like that is not likely to be unhappy in love. You must be joking, Caderousse." "Not at all," the other said. "Just listen to him sigh. Come, Ferdinand, for now, lift your nose off the table and tell us. It is not very mannerly to refuse to answer your friends when they are asking after your health."
"Health is fine," said Fernand, clenching his fist and without looking up. "Ah, Danglars, you see now," Caderousse said, winking at his friend. "This is how things are. Ferdinand here, who is a fine, brave Catalan, is one of the best fishermen in Marseille. He is in love with a beautiful girl called Mercedes, but it appears that, unfortunately, the girl herself is in love with the second mate of the Pharaon, and as the Pharaon came into port this very day, you follow me?" "No, I don't," said Danglars. "Poor Ferdinand has got his marching orders," Caderousse continued. "So what then, Ferdinand, lifting his head and looking at Caderousse like a man anxious to find someone on whom to vent his wrath. "Mercedes is her own woman, isn't she? She's free to love whomever she wants." "Oh, that's how you take it," said Caderousse. "That's another matter. I thought you were a Catalan, and I have been told that the Catalans are not men to let themselves be pushed aside by a rival. They even said that Ferdinand, in particular, was fearsome in his vengeance." Ferdinand smiled pityingly. "A lover is never fearsome," he said. "Poor boy," Danglars continued, pretending to grieve for the young man from the bottom of his heart. "What do you expect? He didn't imagine that Dantès would suddenly return like this. He may have thought him dead or unfaithful. Who knows? Such things are all the more distressing when they happen to us suddenly." "In any event," Caderousse said, drinking as he spoke and starting to show the effects of the heady wine, "in any event, Ferdinand is not the only person to have been put out by Dantès' fortunate return, is he, Danglars?" "No, what you say is true. I might even add that it will bring him some misfortune." "No matter," Caderousse said, pouring out some more wine for Ferdinand and replenishing his own glass for the 8th or 10th time, though Danglars had hardly touched the one in front of him. "No matter. In the meantime, he will marry Mercedes, the lovely Mercedes. He has come back for that, at least." While the other was speaking, Danglars directed a piercing look at the young man, whose heart, Caderousse's words, were falling like molten lead. "And when is the wedding?" he asked. "Oh, it's not settled yet," Fernand muttered. "No, but it will be," said Caderousse, "just as surely as Dantès will be captain of the Pharaon, don't you think, Danglars?" Danglars shuddered at this unexpected stab and turned toward Caderousse, studying his face now to see if the blow had been premeditated. But he saw nothing except covetousness of this on his face, already almost besotted with drink. "Very well," he said, filling the glasses. "Then let's drink to Captain Edmond Dantès, husband of the beautiful Catalan." Caderousse lifted his glass to his lips with a sluggish hand and drained it in one gulp. Ferdinand took his and dashed it to the ground. "Ha-ha," said Caderousse. "What can I see over there on the crest of the hill coming from the Catalan village? You see, Ferdinand, your eyesight is better than mine. I think I'm starting to see less clearly. And as you know, wine is a deceptive imp. It looks to me like two lovers walking along side by side and hand in hand. Heaven forgive me. They don't realize that we can see them. And look at that. They're kissing each other." Danglars marked every single trait of anguish that crossed Ferdinand's face and its features as its features changed before his eyes. "Do you know who they are, Monsieur Ferdinand?" he said. "Yes," the other replied dully. "It's Monsieur Edmond and Mademoiselle Mercedes." "There, you see," said Caderousse. "I didn't recognize them. Hey, Dantès. Hey there, pretty girl. Come down for a moment and let us know when the wedding is. Ferdinand is so stubborn he won't tell." "Why don't you be quiet?" said Danglars, pretending to restrain Caderousse, who, with drunken obstinacy, was leaning out of the arbor. "Try to stay upright and let the lovers enjoy themselves in peace. Why, look at Monsieur Ferdinand. He's being sensible. Why not try and do the same?" It may be that Ferdinand, driven to the limit and baited by Danglars like a bull, would finally have leapt forward, for he had already stood up and appeared to be gathering strength to throw himself at his rival. But Mercedes, upright and laughing, threw back her lovely head and shot a glance from her clear eyes. At that moment, Fernand recalled her threat to die if Edmund should die and slumped back, discouraged, on his chair. Danglars looked at the two men, one besotted by drink, the other enslaved by love, and murmured, "I shall get nothing out of these idiots. I fear I'm sitting between a drunkard and a coward. On one hand, I have a man eaten up by envy, drowning his sorrows in drink when he should be intoxicated with venom. On the other, a great simpleton whose mistress has just been snatched away from under his very nose, who does nothing except weep like a child and feel sorry for himself. And yet he has the blazing eyes of a Spaniard, a Sicilian, or a Calabrian, those people who are such experts when it comes to revenge, and fists that would crush a bull's head as surely as a butcher's mallet. Fate is definitely on Edmund's side. He will marry the beautiful girl, become a captain, and laugh in our faces, unless, a pallid smile hovered on Dangler's lips, unless I take a hand in it. Caderousse, half standing with his fist on the table, was still shouting, "Hello there, hello, Edmund! Can't you see your friends? Are you too proud to talk to them?" "No, my dear Caderousse," Edmund replied. "I am not proud, but I am happy, and happiness, I believe, is even more dazzling than pride." "At last, it is all explained," said Caderousse. "Oh, good day to you, Madame Dantès." Mercedes bowed gravely and said, "That is not yet my name, and in my country they say it is bad luck to call a young woman by the name of her betrothed before he has become her husband. So please, call me Mercedes." "You must forgive my good neighbor, Caderousse," Dante said. "He so seldom makes a mistake." "So, the wedding is to take place shortly, Monsieur Dantès?" Dangler said, greeting the two young people. "As soon as possible, Monsieur Danglars. Today, everything is to be agreed at my father's house, and tomorrow, or at the latest, the day after, we shall have the engagement dinner here at La Réserve. I hope my friends will join us, and you too, of course, are invited, Monsieur Dangler's, and you too, Caderousse. And Fernand?" Caderousse asked with a coarse laugh. "Will Ferdinand be there as well?" "My wife's brother is my brother," Edmund said, "and both Mercedes and I should regret it deeply if he were to be separated from us at such a time." Ferdinand opened his mouth to reply, but his voice caught in his throat, and he could not utter a single word. "The agreement today, the agreement tomorrow, or the day after, by George, you are in a great hurry, Captain." "Danglars," Edmund said with a smile, "I shall say the same to you as Mercedes did a minute ago. Don't give me such a title that does not belong to me yet. It could bring me ill luck." "Oh, my apologies," Danglars replied. "I was merely saying that you seem in a great hurry. After all, we have plenty of time. The Pharaon will not set sail for a good 3 months." "One always hurries toward happiness, Monsieur Danglars, because when one has suffered much, one is at pains to believe in it. But I am not impelled by mere selfishness. I have to go to Paris." "Ah, indeed, to Paris. And what will be your first visit, Dantès?" "And will this be your first visit, Dantès?" "Yes. You have business there?" "Not of my own, but a final request that I must carry out for our poor Captain Leclerc. You understand, Danglars, the mission is sacred to me. In any event, don't worry. I shall be gone only as long as it takes to get there and return." "Yes, yes, I understand," Danglars said aloud, and then added under his breath, "To Paris, no doubt to deliver the letter that the marshal gave him. By heavens, that letter has given me an idea, an excellent idea. Oh, Dantès, my friend, your name is not yet number one on the register of the Pharaon." Then, turning back to Edmund, who was leaving, he shouted, "Bon voyage!" "Thank you," Edmund replied, turning around and giving a friendly wave. Then the two lovers went on their way, calm and happy, as two chosen souls heading for paradise. Chapter 4. The Plot. Dangler's eyes followed Edmund and Mercedes until the two lovers had vanished around the corner of Fort Saint-Nicolas. Then, returning at last, he noticed Fernand, who had slipped back to his chair, pale and trembling, while Caderousse was mumbling the words of a drinking song. "So, my good sir," Danglars told Ferdinand, "not everyone, I think, is happy about this marriage." "I am in despair," said Fernand. "You're in love with Mercedes?" "I adore her." "For a long time?" "Ever since I known her. I've always loved her." "And all you can do is sit there and tear your hair out instead of finding some way out of that dilemma? By God, I didn't know that was how people of your country behaved." "What do you expect me to do?" Ferdinand asked. "How do I know? Is it any of my business? As I see it, I'm not the one who's in love with Mademoiselle Mercedes. You are. Seek and you shall find, the gospel says." "I've found already." "What?" "I wanted to put my knife into the creature, but the girl said if her fiancé was harmed, she would kill herself." "Pah! People say such things, but they don't mean them." "You don't know Mercedes, monsieur. If she threatens to do something, she will." "Idiot," Danglars muttered. "What does it matter whether she kills herself or not, provided Dantès does not become captain?" "And before Mercedes dies," Fernand went on, in firmly resolute tones, "I should die myself." "There's love for you," Caderousse said, in a voice increasingly slurred by drink. "There's love, or I don't know it." Come on, said Danglars, you seem agreeable enough lad to me, and by Jove, I'd like to ease your sorrow, but...
Yes, Caderousse said, come now.
My good friend, Danglars remarked, you are three quarters drunk. Go the whole way and finish the bottle. Drink, but don't interfere with our business, because you need a clear head for what we're doing.
Me? Drunk? Said Caderousse, never.
I could never take another four of your bottles, which are no bigger than bottles of eau de cologne.
Père Pompil, bring us some wine.
And to make the point, Caderousse banged his glass on the table.
You were saying, monsieur? Ferdinand asked, impatient to hear what else Danglars had to tell him.
What was I saying? I don't remember. This drunken Caderousse has quite put it out of my mind.
Drunkard, if you like. A curse on you who fear wine. It's because they have evil thoughts. They are afraid wine will loosen their tongues.
Caderousse began to sing the last two lines of a song which were much in vogue at the time. The flood proved it beyond a doubt. All wicked men do water drink.
You were saying, monsieur, Ferdinand continued, that you like to ease my sorrow, but you added,
but I added, to give you satisfaction, that it is enough for Dantès not to marry the one you love. And this marriage, it seems to me, could not very well take place, even if Dantès does not die.
Only death will separate them, said Ferdinand.
You have the brains of an oyster, my friend, said Caderousse, and Danglars here, who is a sharp one, crafty as a Greek, will prove you wrong. Do it, Danglars. I've stuck up for you. Tell him that Dantès doesn't have to die. In any case, it would be a pity if he died. He's a good lad, Dantès. I like him. Your health, Dantès.
Fernand rose impatiently to his feet.
Let him babble, Danglars said, putting a hand on the young man's arm. And for that matter, drunk as he is, he's not so far wrong. Absence separates effects as effectively as death. So just suppose that there were the walls of a prison between Edmund and Mercedes. That would separate them no more nor less than a tombstone.
Yes, but people get out of prison, said Caderousse, who was gripping the conversation with what remained of his wits.
And then you get out of prison, and you're called Edmond Dantès, and then you take revenge.
What does that matter? Said Fernand.
In any event, Caderousse continued, why should they put Dantès in prison? He hasn't stolen anything, killed anyone, committed any murder.
Shut up, said Danglars.
I don't want to shut up, said Caderousse. I want to know why they would put Dantès in prison. I like Dantès. Dantès, your health. He poured back another glass of wine.
Danglars assessed the extent of the tailor's drunkenness from his dull eyes and turned toward Fernand.
So, do you understand that there is no need to kill him, he said?
No, surely not. As you said a moment ago, there was some means of having Dantès arrested, but do you have such a means?
If we look, Danglars answered, we can find one.
But damn it, why should this concern me? What business is it of mine?
I don't know why it should concern you, Fernand said, grasping his arm. What I do know is that you have some private animosity against Dantès. A man who feels hated cannot be mistaken about that feeling in others.
I have some reason to hate Dantès?
None, I swear. I saw that you were unhappy and took an interest in your unhappiness, that's all. But if you're going to imagine that I'm acting on my own behalf, then farewell, my good friend. You can manage it for yourself.
Here Danglars made himself as if to get up.
No, stay, said Fernand. When it comes down to it, it's of no matter to me whether you have some bone to pick with Dantès or not.
I do, and I freely admit it. Find the means, and I shall carry it out, as long as there is no murder involved. For Mercedes said that she would kill herself if anyone killed Dantès.
Caderousse, who had let his head fall on the table, lifted it and turned his dull, drink-sodden eyes on Fernand and Danglars.
Kill Dantès, he said. Who's talking about killing Dantès? I don't want him killed. He's my friend. This morning he offered to share his money with me, as I shared mine with him. I don't want anyone to kill Dantès.
Who said anything about killing him, idiot? Danglars went on. It's nothing more than a joke. Drink to his health and leave us be, he added, filling Caderousse's glass.
Yes, yes, to Dante's health, said Caderousse, emptying his glass.
His health, like that.
But the means, what about the means, Fernand asked.
You haven't thought of any yet?
No, you said you would do that.
That's true, Danglars said. A Spaniard is inferior to a Frenchman in one respect. Your Spaniard thinks things over, but your Frenchman thinks them up.
Well, think something up then, said Ferdinand impatiently.
Waiter, Danglars called. A pen and ink, paper. A pen, ink, and paper, Ferdinand muttered. Yes, I am an accountant. Pens, inks, and paper are the tools of my trade, and without them I can do nothing. A pen, some ink, and some paper, Ferdinand repeated to the waiter. What you need is over there on the table, the waiter said, indicating the items they had requested. Give them to us, then. The waiter brought the paper, some ink, and a quill pen and put them on the table and in the arbor. When you think, Caderousse said, letting his hand fall into the paper, that what you have here can kill a man more surely than if you were to hide in the woods and murder him. I've always been more afraid of a pen, a bottle of ink, and a sheet of paper than of a sword or a pistol. This clown is not yet as drunk as he seems, said Danglars. Pour him another drink, Fernand. Ferdinand filled Caderousse's glass, and he, like the true drunkard he was, took his hand off the paper and moved it to the glass. The Catalan watched him until Caderousse, almost floored by his new assault, put his glass back, or rather let it fall, onto the table. Well? The Catalan asked, seeing that the last traces of Caderousse's wits had begun to disappear in this final draught of wine. As I was saying, Danglars continued, for example, after a voyage such as the one that Dantès has just made, in the course of which he put in at Naples and the island of Elba, if someone were to denounce him to the Crown Prosecutor as a Bonapartist agent, I'll denounce him. I'll do it, the young man said eagerly. Yes, but in that case, you would have to sign your declaration and be confronted with the man that you accused. I could give you proof to support your accusation, I know, but Dantès cannot stay in prison forever. One day he will come out, and on that day, woe betide the one who put him there. Oh, I couldn't ask for anything better, said Fernand. Let him come and challenge me. Yes, but what about Mercedes? Mercedes, who will hate you if you are unfortunate enough to leave even a scratch on her beloved Edmund. That's true, said Fernand. No, no, Danglars continued. You see, if we were to make up our minds to do such a thing, it would be far better simply to do it, as I am doing now, to take this pen, dip it in ink, and with one's left hand, to disguise the writing, make out a little denunciation in these terms. To illustrate his meaning, Danglars wrote the following lines, with his left hand, the writing slipping backwards so that it bore no resemblance to his usual handwriting, then passing it to Fernand, who read it in a hushed voice. The Crown Prosecutor is advised by a friend in the monarchy and the faith that one Edmond Dantès, first mate on the Pharaon, arriving this morning in Smyrna after putting in at Naples and Porto Ferraro, was entrusted by Murat with a letter from the usurper and by the usurper with a letter to a Bonapartist committee in Paris. Proof of his guilt will be found when he is arrested, since the letter will be discovered on his person, or at the house of his father, or in his cabin, on board the Pharaon. So there we have it, Danglars continued. In this way, your revenge would be consistent with common sense, because it would in no way be traced back to you, and the matter would proceed of its own accord. You would merely have to fold the letter, as I'm doing now, and write on it, to the Crown Prosecutor, then that would settle it. And Danglars wrote the address with a simple stroke of the pen. Yes, that would settle it, said Caderousse, who had made one final effort to muster his wits and follow the reading of the letter, and understood instinctively that all the misfortune that such a denunciation would bring. Yes, that would settle it, except that it would be a vile act. And he reached over to take the letter. Which is why, Danglars, pushing it beyond the reach of his hand, which is why I am saying and doing it is simply in jest. And I should be the first to be upset if anything were happened to Dantès, dear Dantès, so watch. He took the letter, crumpled it in his hands, and threw it into a corner of the arbor. That's right, said Caderousse. Dantès is my friend, and I don't want anyone to harm him. The devil take it. Who would think of doing him harm? Certainly not I or Ferdinand, said Danglars, getting up and looking at the young man, who had remained seated, but who had his covetous eye fixed sideways on the accusing letter where it had fallen. In that case, Caderousse went on, bring us more wine. I want to drink to the health of Edmund and the lovely Mercedes. You've had enough to drink already, you tippler, said Danglars. If you go on, you will have to sleep here, because you won't be able to stand up. Me? Said Caderousse, rising with the ridiculous movement of a drunken man. Me? Not able to stand up? I wager I could go up to the belfry of La Coule, and without wavering. Well, if you wish, said Danglars. I accept the wager, but for tomorrow. Today it is time to go home, so give me your arm and we'll get started. "Let's go," said Caderousse, "but I don't need your arm for it. Are you coming, Fernand? Come with us to Marseille." "No," Fernand said. "I'm going back to Le Catalan." "Don't be silly. Come with us to Marseille. Come on." "I have no business in Marseille, and I don't want to go there." "What did you say? You don't want to, my lad? Well, do as you wish. Everyone can do as he wishes. Come on, Danglars, and let's let this gentleman go back to the Catalans, since that's what he wants." Danglars took advantage of Caderousse's momentary amenability to drag him toward Marseille, but to leave a shorter and easier way free for Fernand, instead of going back via the Quai de la Reve Neuve, he went through the Porte Saint-Victor. Caderousse followed, swaying and gripping his arm. When he had gone some 20 yards, Danglars turned around and saw Fernand grab a piece of paper and put it in his pocket. Then, running out of the arbor, the young man immediately went in the direction of Le Pilon. "There! Hey! What's he up to?" said Caderousse. "He lied to us. He said he was going to Le Catalan, and now he's headed into town. Hey, Fernand, my boy, you're going the wrong way." "It's you who can't see properly," said Danglars. "He's gone straight down the road to Ville Infirmerie." "Has he?" said Caderousse. "Well, I could have sworn that he turned to the right. Really, wine is such a deceiver." "Come on, come on," Danglars muttered. "I think the matter is properly underway now, and all we have to do is let it take its course." We've run out of time for this hour of The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas, translated by Robin Boose. We'll pick up right where we left off in the next episode. So today we read chapters 2, 3, and 4. My name is Larissa Biggers from the North Carolina Reading Service, providing news and information for individuals who are blind or print impaired. Our website is ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.